Chapter 3, The Nested Model of Attachment and Trauma. So far, we have covered the different attachment styles and looked at how these relate to the different dimensions of attachment avoidance and attachment anxiety, as well as the horizontal dimension of autonomy and connection. In this chapter, I offer an additional perspective to our discussion of attachment in an attempt to diversify the levels or dimensions at which we consider and contemplate our attachment experiences. This will support our discussion of attachment and non-monogamy in part 2 of the book. It is difficult to talk about attachment without talking about trauma. And so before I present on the different levels, a definition of trauma is also needed. The word trauma comes from the Greek word wound, which was initially used to refer to physical injuries. The definition has since expanded to further encompass psychological and spiritual wounds as well. In many ways, the lasting psychological impact of trauma has become much more central to the study and treatment of trauma than the physical, since mental and emotional symptoms can persist long after the physical body has healed, and many traumas occur without the body even being touched. Trauma can result from a single event, a series of events, or multiple sets of circumstances that cause physical, emotional, psychological, or spiritual harm. Single incident traumas include one-off events such as robberies, assaults, accidents, or natural disasters. Complex and relational trauma are terms used to describe the experience of multiple traumatic events that are ongoing, such as abuse or neglect, that are interpersonal in nature. Traumatic events and experiences can be especially impactful in the earlier years of life. A distressing event at a young age can potentially negatively impact brain development, and if it is perpetrated by an attachment figure, it can be particularly harmful. Our fundamental sense of self and sense of safety in the world can be painfully called into question when the ones we are dependent on either can't keep us safe or are the ones we need protection from. Traumas are the events and situations that overwhelm us, leaving us feeling out of control, helpless, and alone. Not everyone experiences trauma the same way, and not everyone who goes through the same events will necessarily be traumatized. Trauma occurs on a continuum of stress, and the difference between a traumatic experience versus a bad or stressful experience is the impact on our body's ability to recover. When something stressful occurs, our bodies are wired to release an entire cocktail of chemicals into our bloodstream to activate the sympathetic nervous system fight, flight, freeze, appease, defense response. This is meant to be a short-term strategy to keep us alive. Once the event is over, our bodies are supposed to return to a state of parasympathetic nervous system balance, where we can function as usual in a calm and clear-minded way. But bigger traumatic events can activate our natural stress response to such a degree that our nervous system is overwhelmed and dysregulated, to the point that this chemical cocktail is unable to be processed and we are left unable to fully recover. This can have a lasting effect on the nervous system, and when left untreated, trauma can interfere with our ability to inhabit our bodies, exhibit mental flexibility, function in everyday ways, learn, grow, love, and securely attach. Left unresolved, trauma can cause us to experience ongoing adverse effects on our physical, psychological, social, occupational, and spiritual well-being. However, enormous stressors or big overwhelming events are not the only ways that a person's nervous system can be activated and overwhelmed to the point of experiencing trauma. We can also experience smaller but ongoing stressful events that have a cumulative harmful effect. Instead of getting a single massive blast of the survival cocktail into our bloodstream when we experience a car accident, a natural disaster, or a physical assault, We can get little blasts throughout the day from experiences like demanding work environments, relationship tension, health issues, life transitions, traffic jams, parenting, etc. Our bodies need time to metabolize the chemical cocktail released from stress. And when we are in a chronic state of stress, whether big or small, physical, emotional, psychological, environmental, or existential, we can get pushed over the edge into a state of sympathetic nervous system dominance. This means that the survival response that was meant to be temporary has now become constant. The threat that we experience does not even need to be real, but the repeated perception of a threat day after day can push our nervous system into a traumatized state. When this happens, we are living in survival mode, stuck in sympathetic dominance and unable to access our ability to recover and thrive. Some trauma experts have begun to further simplify the definition of trauma, framing it as the experience of broken connection. From an attachment perspective, this makes sense since broken connection with an attachment figure could mean death to an infant or a young child. And so being disconnected from our attachment figures can be in and of itself traumatic. But the trauma of broken connection also occurs through the massive disconnection that someone has to have with their self and with another person when enacting interpersonal harm. Attachment is related to this, since having a history of secure attachment acts as a protective buffer against trauma. Research shows that in the aftermath of trauma, people who are well connected with others are more likely to recover faster and less likely to experience post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Conversely, people with a disorganized attachment history are more likely to develop PTSD after traumatic experiences. Seeing trauma as a result of broken connection also makes it difficult to tease trauma and attachment apart from each other, since the absence of safe, nurturing relationships can lead to trauma, and having safe and nurturing relationships can serve as a shield in the face of other traumas. As you will see in the nested model of attachment and trauma, trauma and attachment wounds are not just an individual or relational experience. They also stem from the world we are in, where injustice and power imbalances still exist, and where generations of cultural and collective traumas have been unaddressed, all shaping and informing our experiences. The nested model of attachment and trauma. Attachment unfolds over multiple levels of the human experience. When referring to different levels of experience, I am pointing to the different dimensions or aspects of our human experience, such as self, relationships, home, local communities and culture, societal, and the global or collective. These different levels may seem separate and different from one another, yet they are all interconnected, with each level acting as an important ingredient to our experience and informing any given moment, as well as the decisions we make. To offer you just a simple example, if I am looking to buy a new car, there are several different facets or levels of my life that can influence my decision. At the self level, I might think about which car most appeals to me based on my individual preferences, my likes, dislikes, needs, and what I can afford. If I expand beyond my personal perspective to the relational level, I will consider which car would be best for my family, including my son's needs. Additionally, the cultural level informs what kind of car I would consider purchasing based on how I do or do not want to be perceived by others. The range of cars I have access to in the US falls under the societal level, and the considerations such as electric versus gas come under the global or collective levels. In discussion of the nested model of attachment and trauma, I will refer to the different facets, dimensions, or perspectives of our lives that coalesce into the whole of our experience, even if we are unaware of them. The current literature on attachment predominantly focuses on the self and relationship levels. That is, on identifying our individual attachment styles and considering them in connection to our relationship experiences. Concentrating on just these two levels of experience is perfectly understandable, since our relational level experiences of having our attachment needs met or not shape how the self is formed and developed. Subsequently, the attachment styles that arise at the self level feeds back into our relational level, informing how we show up within our relationships. In many ways, we can see attachment as a nice feedback loop in which relationships shape the individual, and individuals then shape their relationships, with relationships further reshaping the individual, and so on, repeatedly. We could easily keep the discussion limited to these two levels, but there are additional facets to our experience of attachment and trauma that are important to explore. The levels of home, culture, society, and the collective all factor into how safe and secure we feel in the world, with others, and within ourselves. If we fail to include these levels in our understanding of attachment and trauma, we can run the risk of either reducing experiences that impact attachment to the self or relationship levels when they are actually occurring at another level, or we run the risk of missing these factors altogether. For example, consider poverty, gender expectations, or institutionalized birth practices, and how each of these may impact attachment and trauma. Since all of the levels of experience are not actually separate from one another, each level interacts with and influences the other, I have chosen to present them as nested. The self level. The innermost circle represents you, the individual self who has a certain temperament, a one-of-a-kind genetic and epigenetic expression, a specific attachment history, and a unique way of experiencing those attachment styles. This circle holds the interior experience of your thoughts and feelings, how you see and identify yourself, and how you perceive, interpret, and think about others. Here resides all of your skills and abilities, as well as your longings, aversions, hopes, and fears. All of the ways that you do or do not take care of yourself reside in this circle, as do your capacities for introspection and reflection, and all the ways you either do or do not feel grounded, secure, and safe in your own being. The next level out is the relationship level. This level refers to your one-on-one interpersonal experiences with your parents, family members, close friends, lovers, and partners. It holds the quality of interactions that you have had with your attachment figures, how you have been treated, and how you have treated others. When we talk about our attachment needs being met or not met by our attachment figures, we are referring to this level. And it is what happens at this level that then flows down and transfers to the self level, affecting whether we take on a more secure or insecure attachment style. The self level also impacts this level by influencing the ways that we show up in the relational space. At this relational level, traumatic experiences such as physical, sexual, or emotional abuse, neglect, or intimate partner violence all play a part in our ability to attach. Complex and relational trauma can occur from ongoing harm or abandonment from a primary attachment figure, whether from a parent or from a romantic partner as an adult. When mistreatment and harm occur from a trusted loved one, the effect can be especially damaging to the attachment system, bringing into question whether anyone is safe to be trusted and relied on. Single incident traumas such as car accidents, medical procedures, or a one-time assault may not have originated from this relational level, but they will also impact a person's ability to securely attach at this level. Regardless of which level our attachment wounds first take place in, our insecure attachment styles can be healed through this relationship level. This can occur by having our needs met from attuned, responsive partners, or even having reparative experiences with the ones we have been hurt by. Research and literature on attachment have provided undeniable evidence about how relationships with our parents and lovers shape our attachment style. But the impact of siblings is not as commonly discussed, despite being just as important to our attachment style. In therapy, I've seen many clients who identify their interactions with siblings as the source of their attachment wounds. Sometimes this stems from parents who neglect to protect siblings from each other, placing one sibling's needs over the other, or practicing outright favoritism. But other times, the disruption is directly between the siblings. Attachment ruptures with siblings can occur when there has been overt emotional or verbal abuse, bullying, physical abuse, or outright rejection. Disconnection resulting from a large age or personality difference, competitiveness, and consistent misattuned teasing all show up in the therapy room as attachment disruptions from sibling relationships. These experiences can impact a person's ability to make meaningful connections with romantic partners as an adult. Culturally, in the West, we tend to see romantic and parental relationships as superior in influence to others. And studies have shown that adult attachments are mostly directed towards a romantic sexual partner over adult friendships. But our relationships with siblings or close friends can function as some of the most important attachment bonds that we have. For many, a friend or sibling can serve as a primary attachment figure, and when there has been attachment wounding with partners or parents, it is these very connections that can provide the corrective attachment experiences and healing from those attachment disruptions we've had with others at the relational level. Friendships that function as a primary attachment can also leave a painful mark on one's heart and a significant attachment disturbance when there is betrayal, dishonesty, ghosting, or drama that ends in the loss of the friendship. Death or loss of a close friend can create massive shockwaves in our attachment systems. The home level. This next level goes beyond the one-to-one interactions at the relational level and considers the ways in which our family interacted as a whole and how our actual physical home impacted our attachment. This includes the number of people in your home, the type of home culture and place you grew up in, how many generations of family members were living in your home, whether you had to go back and forth between your parents' homes due to separation or divorce, or whether or not you even had a home. These factors can all have a supportive or straining influence on your ability to attach and feel safe with the people you live with. Were you one of 8 siblings and felt like there was an abundance of love and attention? Did you always have someone to talk to or play with? Or were you one of 8 siblings who competed for food or attention and your needs easily got lost in the crowd? Were there multiple generations in your home, which might have filled the gaps or created a bridge between you and your parents? Or did having a multi-generational home detract from what your parents were able to offer you? Were there sick people in your house? Did you have a blended home with step-parents and step-siblings? Were you an introvert, which would be the self level, living within a family of extroverts, or an artist living with a family of scientists? Were there pets in your home that you bonded with or pets that you were allergic to? What habits and routines did your family have and how did they impact your attachment experience? All of these experiences at the home level can influence our sense of belonging and whether or not we feel safe and secure within ourselves, our relationships, and the world. This level also includes the physical environment, such as whether or not you liked your childhood physical home and bedroom, if you even had one, and felt safe there. If the home was too messy or too clean, too quiet or too noisy, or otherwise not well matched with you, it could potentially create stress and tension in the nervous system, prodding us into survival stress responses. One therapy client of mine was able to connect how her current preoccupied attachment style was related to her experience of moving homes too many times as a child. Her relational level experience of attachment with her parents was very secure, but moving homes four times in just a few short years created a sense of constant underlying uneasiness in her body due to the repeated loss of friends, schools, and home. She developed a mental storyline that whenever she got comfortable and started to feel settled in a new place, the rug just got ripped out from under her. Consistency of home was very important to her, and this uneasiness created from the home level was now impacting her ability to trust that her romantic partner's affection could be stable and enduring at the relational level, causing her to experience higher levels of attachment anxiety. Another client reflected on how their experience of living in a rat-infested home contributed to their higher levels of attachment avoidance. Living among rats meant that there were certain closets, drawers, even rooms in their home that they steered clear of to avoid a rat encounter. The only way they felt safe was to withdraw into the few locations in their apartment that were relatively rat-free. In therapy, they came to see how this withdrawal included the minimizing of their desire for connection with their parents and siblings, because wanting to be close to others would have required them to go into parts of the house that felt unsafe. As they got older and more social, they felt too embarrassed to have friends over and would often spend more time at friends' homes to avoid their own. The shame and embarrassment that they experienced at the self level because of their home level environment contributed to higher levels of attachment avoidance and discomfort with intimacy at the relational level. As this client and I processed through their early attachment experiences at the home level and restored a sense of safety in their nervous system around what it felt like to be in their home now, they were then able to shift into more secure functioning at the self and relationship levels. The local culture and communities level. Sometimes stressors, traumas, and attachment struggles come from beyond the home, relational, or self levels, and instead stem from the culture and communities that we are embedded in. The local culture and community level refers to the places where we spend our time outside of our home, such as work, school, friends' houses, the gym, clubs, as well as sports venues and religious or spiritual centers. Culture can be rich, complex, and contrasting, and we may find ourselves within several different cultures and communities that each have a different set of social rules, ways of relating, and expectations for what it means to be an accepted member. People who do not fit into the norms of their communities can experience attachment insecurity and trauma if they feel that being themselves or expressing who they are will cause harm or be dangerous. If we have to conceal and contort who we are, our foundational relationship with ourselves can get severed and interfere with how we then experience the levels of relationship and home. Unfortunately, many people experience harm or violation by trusted community members, mentors, teachers, or clergy. These experiences can leave a lasting mark on how safe someone feels in groups, as well as how worthy someone feels about being able to give and receive love. Growing up in Brooklyn, New York, I was fortunate to be invited into the homes of my friends, many of whom were first-generation Americans. The ways my friend's Cuban mother spoke to, disciplined, cared for, and touched her child were vastly different from the ways my Irish-American friends were treated by their parents, which were both considerably distinct from the Italian, Russian, Puerto Rican, African-American, and Greek homes I entered. Some families were affectionate and effusive. Others were distant and stoic. Some were physically present and practically consistent, but emotionally hesitant. Looking back, I can see how the ways that each of my friends were parented had a lot to do with the language, culture, and religion of their parents, with each culture having different expectations about what it meant to be a parent, what discipline was, how and when you used it, and how a child was supposed to behave. These cultural narratives, which are often implicit and taken for granted, shaped how available, responsive, and attuned these parents were to their children's attachment needs. Today, the local culture and community level also includes virtual culture and online communities. We can physically be in our homes, but have our minds and hearts somewhere else completely in the virtual world. In their online course, Secure Attachment Parenting in the Digital Age, Diane Poole Heller and Kim John Payne discuss the particular challenges that our current society faces regarding attachment and technology. They highlight the potential damaging effects that overuse of technology has on both the parent and child's ability to develop emotional bonds. The addition of screens into our already busy lives can add further strain on important face-to-face connection time between parents and their children. While use of technology is more and more of a social requirement at even very young ages, for many parents it is also a needed crutch, often due to financial necessity. If all the adults in the home need to work, screen time can become the babysitter or give the parents the break that they need just to make dinner or maintain the bare basics of their home. Even though we are ostensibly more connected than ever through our phones, tablets, and other devices, studies have shown that in adults in the U.S. aged 19 to 32, higher social media use can lead to feeling more socially isolated and emotionally disconnected than people with lower social media use. I also see how emotionally overwhelming it can be when the absence of face-to-face contact enables a certain boldness or even meanness from people that they would not necessarily enact in person. Online attacks and rejections of others can cause a great deal of loss and psychological injury. As in all the levels, there can be damage and trauma at the local culture and community level, but there can, of course, also be healing. When someone grows up in a home or town where no one really looks and feels like they do, finding an online community where their voice and experiences are received, honored, and even celebrated can be deeply healing to their sense of self and connection. School culture is another important aspect to this level. Since most children spend the majority of their waking hours in the classroom, cafeterias, and schoolyard. I once had a client who joked that you should never trust anyone who said they liked their junior high school experience. I later learned that this comment was the sarcastic mask in front of some very painful and traumatic experiences she went through in her early adolescence. Now in her 40s, this woman had lasting scars from the social hierarchies and mean girl culture at her junior high school. She had experienced overt social rejection and repeated emotional and verbal cruelty from her peers. Coupled with the highly competitive academic culture of her school, the educational and social pressures became too unbearable, and thus she attempted to take her life at just age 13. While I was writing this book, my father sent me a newspaper article in which he was interviewed about the sexual assault he experienced from his high school principal over 40 years earlier. In the article, he is quoted as relating the alcoholism, drug addiction, and mental illness of his adult life as having its origin in the profound shame he experienced from being sexually assaulted at school. When I spoke to him about it, he also added that the years of corporal punishment and the Catholic school culture of overt disapproval just further reinforced and solidified his shame. His traumas at this level had a lasting effect on his ability to bond with me as my parent. When I was 8 years old, my father went into rehab. But his sobriety did not initially improve our relationship as much as both of us might have anticipated. Although the alcoholism and drug addiction were treated, his trauma, shame, and deep-rooted feeling of unworthiness to be loved, even from his own child, remained for decades. My father had a strong desire to be available to me, but the absence of healing from his high school traumas and the ensuing shame left him in many ways incapable of bonding, connecting, and responding in the nurturing, present, and attuned ways that both of us wanted. How safe we feel on the streets of our neighborhood, whether we have to lock our front door or not, how welcome and embraced we feel from the communities that we encounter, and whether the leaders of our various communities are benevolent or unkind, are all factors that I see as impacting our sense of safety, security, and ability to explore. Traumas that arise from bullying, community violence, or school shootings should not be underestimated. But although many different types of attachment traumas can happen at this level, it is also a level that can offer needed healing and attachment repair. The homes of friends, spiritual communities, substance abuse support groups, sports and dance teams, or online communities can become our safe havens, where we are freer to be ourselves and are understood and are seen and loved for who we are. The societal level. The next outer dimension in this nested model refers to the larger societal structures and systems that we live in, such as our economic, legal, medical, and political systems, as well as our religious institutions. It is at the societal level that prejudice and oppression are institutionalized through the laws and power structures that either favor or discriminate against people based on age, race, class, sex, physical ability, sexual orientation, and relationship orientation, including monogamy and polyamory. Who is considered legally legitimate or not at a societal level? Who has access to healthcare and education, whether or not you have rights to your children, or whether or not you are subject to the institutionalization of birth practices that can interfere with parent-child bonding, are all factors that can be traumatizing and attachment compromising. Additionally, whether or not we are part of a legally protected class has massive implications for how safe and secure we feel in the world. The sociologist Johann Galtung refers to this as structural violence. Distinguished from physical violence, yet often intertwined, structural violence refers to a type of violence that is often invisible, yet intricately built into societal structures. People's lives are complicated, confined, or even lost because of heterosexism, classism, racism, ableism, and sexism. Structural violence may be less obvious and direct than physical violence, but it is just as impactful and harmful. It creates a disparity between a person's potential reality, the life they could conceivably live, compared to the limited reality that they find themselves in. Societal issues, including homophobia, racism, sexism, and mononormativity, do not exist solely at the societal level. They influence and play out in very real and impactful ways, including the neighborhoods and homes we live in, which schools we have access to and what funding they receive, how we approach or avoid others, and how we are treated by teachers, taxi drivers, or clerks at the grocery store. A Black man is likely to have a very different experience of how safe and secure he feels when walking past a police officer than a white woman in the same scenario. In a time when mass shootings are rampant in the U.S. and amid the current political climate, a person of color who practices Islam will likely feel very differently walking into a mosque than a white Catholic person walking into a church. These societal experiences can then trickle all the way down to the self level, where social level issues become internalized as forms of shame and self-loathing, again, hindering one's ability to bond, attach, and connect. Studies have shown that children with socioeconomic risks are more likely to develop disorganized attachment, and that children are at an increased risk of disorganized attachment when they are in non-maternal care for more than 60 hours a week due to parental work hours. Is it honestly possible to feel safe and secure in a capitalist society that defines our human value based on what we do and how much we make, rather than who we are? Is it honestly possible to feel safe and secure in a society that bombards us with messages asserting, even aggressing, that in order to be secure in ourselves or with our place in the world, we need to acquire more money, more religion, more objects, more products, more body-altering procedures, or more property? Society teaches us how to love and who is worthy of love, via the media, commercials, and through institutionalized practices such as tax benefits for married couples. Relationships are defined as valuable, and potential partners are evaluated as worthy based on how much money is spent on dinner, date nights, vacations, diamonds, and wedding arrangements. Flipping to the other extreme and thinking that money doesn't matter at all or is unimportant in a relationship can also be damaging, since we live in a society where money is a basic requirement for survival. It's difficult to show up and thrive in relationships when we can't feed ourselves, pay the bills, or afford basic health care. In addition to the ways that capitalism can influence who and how we love, in couples therapy, I regularly witness how patriarchal values and gender discourses eclipse intimate connection and attachment. Developing healthy relational attachment requires feelings of safety and security. While significant achievements have been made for women over the past several decades, many women still experience sexism, objectification, invisibility, exclusion, or even servitude within their most intimate relationships. My generation was taught that girls can do anything that boys can do. But most of my peers still feel the need to have to shave, pluck, color, tint, laser, push up, or add extensions to part of their bodies just to achieve baseline attractiveness and feel good enough to walk out the door every day. For many women, feminism has added more criteria to what it means to be a woman. In commenting on how increased racial and ethnic diversity in Hollywood has had a positive change on body image, the comedian Tina Fey credits women like Jennifer Lopez and Beyoncé for revising the definition of American beauty. Being skinny is no longer the only ideal, but having a larger butt and thighs is now also considered desirable. These changes have definitely added more nuance to our beauty standards and represent positive developments, particularly for racialized women, larger-bodied women, trans women, and disabled women who have typically been found wanting or lesser than in comparison to the narrow beauty norms of privileged, thin, cisgendered, able-bodied white women. However, Tina Fey points out these changes did not necessarily emancipate all women to embrace their body as it is, but rather, quote, added to the laundry list of attributes women must have to qualify as beautiful. Now every girl is expected to have Caucasian blue eyes, full Spanish lips, a classic button nose, hairless Asian skin with a California tan, a Jamaican dancehall ass, long Swedish legs, small Japanese feet, the abs of a lesbian gym owner, the hips of a 9-year-old boy, the arms of Michelle Obama, and doll tits, unquote. In addition to inflated beauty standards, women are now also expected to be career-driven, achievement-oriented, financially independent, and a competent badass in the boardroom bedroom, kitchen, and nursery. On the flip side, the plights of men are often dismissed and unseen, since men are regarded as the ones wielding all the privilege and power. But what happens when the same societal structures that grant men superiority also deny them the full range of human emotions and threaten their status as men if they experience even the slightest form of sensitivity, vulnerability, or indication of their need for love, emotional safety, and tenderness? Basically, if men admit to having any attachment needs at all. What happens when men are paralyzed by shame and made to feel unworthy of love and partnership unless they meet certain masculine expectations around financial or professional success? And what happens to a person's ability to feel safe and connected when they are transgendered or do not fit into the gender binary at all? Many of the personal problems and relationship struggles that we face are actually societal issues, impairing our ability to bond, connect, and love in secure ways. The global or collective level. The earth is alive. It is where we come from, it is what nourishes life, and it is where we will return to. If we're going to talk about attachment relationships, it would be remiss not to mention our original mother, Mother Earth. For many of us, our relationship with the environment is dissociative and overly abstracted. Even though the earth is the very ground upon which we move, we still see it as separate, unaffected, and removed from our daily existence. Growing up in New York City, it was frequently modeled to me that the ground was not a place to revere or enjoy. This was mostly because actual areas of earth and grass in the city were few and far between. What I saw instead was that the earth was something to pour concrete over, to drive over, to blast through, to take for granted, or the place to literally throw your trash. The earth was more of a means to an end, a resource to take from instead of a living entity to be in relationship with. I think it's safe to say that in the U.S., many people have a dismissive attachment to the earth. They downplay its importance, cutting off any potential experience of wisdom or intimacy that could be gained through connection with the natural world. On a daily basis, people are immediately confronted with the sudden and overwhelming realities of our planet through fires, floods, hurricanes, earthquakes, tornadoes, tsunamis, volcanoes, and pandemics. Needless to say, it can be traumatizing to lose loved ones, homes, and entire communities in natural disasters. Access to post-disaster aid and support can also be further traumatizing when poverty, racism, or public policy further influence who and how and when people are helped. In a 2019 TED Talk, How Climate Change Affects Your Mental Health, Britt Ray articulates the ways in which natural disasters can lead to increased PTSD and suicide in survivors. She addresses how our changing environment threatens our social, mental, relational, and spiritual health, and how some psychologists are treating pre-traumatic stress in regard to climate change. Gia Woodbury explains that humans are being confronted with a new type of trauma that has never been confronted before, one that is ongoing and continuous without immediate solutions, and which calls into question our shared identity as humans. In an article titled Climate Trauma: Towards a New Taxonomy of Traumatology, he writes, quote, "Climate trauma is an ever-present existential threat with a bevy of constant cognitive reminders, melting ice caps, eroding shorelines, waves of homeless refugees, the ravaging storms, floods and fires broadcast into our homes 24/7, and the constant roll call of disappearing species, vanishing rainforests, and dying coral reefs. There are certain things in life that we cannot unsee, and climate trauma indelibly stamps our consciousness in that way, fundamentally altering the way we see the world and our place in it, unquote. Not everyone is currently or directly in harm's way of natural disasters, but many of us still experience climate trauma or a preoccupied attachment to the earth by living in daily anxiety about the state of our water, air pollution, the state of forests, the loss of biodiversity, and the extinction of animal species, just to name a few. For one of my clients, the bulk of our therapy has revolved around her environmental anxiety and its impact on every area of her life. When she wakes up every day, she looks through her window to what she sees as a world in peril. She is personally pained by the manifold ways that humans are mistreating the planet. Even though she has everything she needs on a physical level, she often tells me that if the environment isn't okay, then I'm just not okay. She feels intensely unsafe and unstable living in a world where a natural disaster could occur at any time, and where the future sustainability of human life seems so precarious. This particular client illuminated for me how the current state of the earth has changed the way in which some people orient to their personal future, and even to their individual sense of purpose. Where for many it appears to be a given truth that we are working towards a better future for the next generations, infusing our individual life with a larger sense of meaning. For this client, the future was no longer something secure that she could hang her sense of meaning and fulfillment on. Another client of mine always felt a strong sense that the meaning of his life had everything to do with becoming a father. Ever since he could remember, he desired to be a dad, seeing parenthood as his greatest contribution to this life. When he learned more about global issues such as overpopulation and food scarcity, it seriously called into question whether having a child made sense for him anymore. His concern for the environment ignited a personal identity crisis as he contemplated who he would be and what he would do if having children no longer seemed viable or wise from an environmental perspective. His worry for the planet created a state of constant urgency in his internal nervous system and hypervigilance that disrupted his work and marriage. With both of these clients, I found that by treating their attachment anxiety with the environment the same way I would work with relational attachment trauma, they were both able to rebuild an inner sense of safety and security. Each of them developed a larger felt sense of trust in the wisdom and support that the earth has to offer, while also feeling more empowered rather than overwhelmed or complacent about their environmental efforts. Finally, in talking about the global level, it is also extremely important to highlight collective trauma. This is the traumatic impact that happens to societies over multiple generations when experiences like slavery, genocide, famine, war, or the subjugation of women occur. The individuals who experience these events are undeniably impacted. But the effect also transcends the individual, altering the course of the world in unfathomable and incalculable ways. Thomas Hubel is the co-founder of The Pocket Project, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the healing of collective trauma. He posits that we currently exist in a traumatized collective. And the main symptom of being in a traumatized world is that we feel separate from one another, from the world, from spirit, and from the natural world as a whole. These symptoms are not just present in the collective or even individual psyches, but can become evident through actual changes in our genetic expression. Unresolved trauma from previous generations can alter the expression of DNA, making subsequent generations more susceptible to certain health issues, increased anxiety, PTSD, and wariness to danger. This means that certain mental health or physical symptoms that you are experiencing today at the self level may have actually been inherited from collective traumas that your ancestors went through generations ago. Traumas arise in many forms over multiple generations, and how each person and their nervous system responds to the very same incident can vary greatly in degree. Trauma and attachment wounds separate us from feeling safe and secure, and left unaddressed, they can create serious impairments in our ability to connect, respond, or even function. All of these levels can cause threats, ruptures, and violations that activate the attachment system. This means that each level has the potential to impact how safe we feel in our bodies, with others, and in the world at large. Living in regular chaos, fear, or uncertainty is not conducive to secure attachment. At each separate level, we can look at the potential trauma occurring at that level and see how it then permeates to all of the levels above and below. Traumas that continue to occur at the levels of culture, society, and the collective cannot entirely be healed by the individual, but that does not mean that they are beyond cleansing and repair at the self and relationship levels, where we do have more power to take responsibility for our own healing. As I've already alluded to, healing is available to all of us at these different levels too. When ruptures occur at one level, we can focus our healing on that specific level, but we must also utilize the repair and respite that the other levels have to offer us, whether through self-compassion, a warm embrace from a loved one, a home where we can relax, being acknowledged and accepted within a community, receiving legal rights or benefits that were previously denied, or just a quiet walk in nature to restore our inner equilibrium.